I did a pre-theme song intro in the first episode. I feel like for Gator's sake, I should tell you also, since this is our second episode, Bubba made the theme song unsolicited. Bubba just decided when he found out this was going to be called Five Whiskey Patrick, that, and then he made this.
It's Five Whiskey Patrick.
I know you're jealous. I know you are. You probably want to sign him right now. That's pretty impressive.
Are you like Peter on Family Guy? Do you have that on your phone everywhere you go when you walk in the room? You hit play?
Actually, I don't play it until we achieve Five Whiskey Patrick, and then I'm at a party somewhere, and you hear that, and you go, oh, it's time. It's time. So, my guest this week, Gator Michaels, not a real name. Gator has been a friend of mine for 15 or so years.
Since you were a child.
Since I was a child in this business. And I don't know. We play poker together. We have a lot of fun laughing and goofing off. And I thought, you know what? Well, this would be a good way to go with the second episode. Get someone with some actual clout and, you know, influence in the music business, and have them come in here and not talk about that at all.
Who else is coming?
Just you, buddy. That's it. So before we get started, my mother-in-law, my future mother-in-law, gave me a set of whiskey glasses for Christmas, which I think is just an absolute way of just saying, I understand you drink whiskey, and I'm okay with it. But because of that, we're going to use these brand new, beautiful, pristine whiskey glasses, and today we are drinking John Rich's Redneck Riviera whiskey. Not for any reason other than that I have some and it's really good. I will say that. So
I notice your mother-in-law is trying to turn you into Six Whiskey Patrick.
Yeah, she sent me six whiskey glasses. You like that?
I mean, that's even a bigger endorsement.
No, it's a way of saying, I don't mind that you drink whiskey, but I mind that you're drinking it at home out of plastic cups. That's what it says.
And alone.
And alone. So here's a bunch of glasses where you can drink.
Cheers.
Cheers. You can drink with friends. So I will say something about John's whiskey. It is a very good whiskey, but this is going to sound bad, but it's a great whiskey for the price. Like, over the top good for how little it costs right now. So if you haven't tried it and you can't get it in your area, I think they can ship it to you. I don't know. This is not an ad because we're not currently sponsored by any whiskey.
And as a record or a music geek, I guess, go find a John Anderson album that John Rich produced and wrote a song about brown liquor. And then
get
a bottle of
his
whiskey and listen to that album.
Were you involved in that album?
Yeah.
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 Tell me about that. That was back at...
It was at Warner. Warner? Technically Raybaugh, which was the imprint we had for John and Kenny. Mm-hmm. Red and yellow, black and white, Raybaugh. And your upstairs neighbor ran that company for them, by the way, Virginia Davis.
Did she?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Small world.
Yeah. That's where I know Ginger from, and we had that time together. And, you know, John Anderson as John referred to him, was his hillbilly hero. You know, he grew up as I did with, you know, swinging and chicken truck and great John Anderson classics. And it was one of the highlights of my life as a redneck kid from Oklahoma to say you worked with John Anderson. And I mean, he, you know, truly was just an icon to me.
Right.
Growing up and I loved it. It was a great time. And John is a brilliant, I used to tell John that for me, when he is inducted into the Hall of Fame, he will be known more as a producer than as an artist.
John Rich.
Yes.
Yes.
John Rich. Yes. John Rich. Because he has vision. And I used to call him the Quincy Jones of country music.
Oh, I used to think of him. And you mentioned that, and he's a great producer. I used to think of him as a songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
I remember there was a time where even when he was having his biggest hits on the radio with Big and Rich, that the songs he was writing for other people.
Yeah.
You know, for Jason Aldean and Faith Hill. And a lot of people don't even realize him. He wrote Mississippi Girl. He wrote Was it Hicktown or Johnny Cash or both?
Yeah. There was a time during the height of Big and Rich, and I don't remember what the exact number was, but I want to say that John had written 7 or 8 songs on the top 40 in like that time frame.
There are people like that, like now, like Ashley Gourley with all these co-writes and stuff, where you have these guys who have that, and it's part of the way the music industry, country music, is right now. But at that time, that was unheard of.
Yeah. Well,
for it to be someone who was a known artist, you know, the public has heard of, as opposed to some of these songwriters that, you know, are just writing behind the scenes. No, this was John's like second job to be a songwriter.
I mean, John, once Big and Rich happened, he also wrote Redneck Woman.
Redneck Woman.
Yeah.
Maybe the most successful single of that decade. Yeah.
But as is the case in Nashville quite often, the moment their success, John had been writing songs for 10 years, and that catalog just got devoured. People were just digging through it, going, where's a John Rich hit? Where's a John Rich hit? And it wasn't hard to look and find one, because there were a lot of them.
Yeah.
He is brilliant. He truly is. People use the term a lot. John's brilliant on all sorts of levels, including being incredibly intelligent. And
so we're going to come back to this conversation, because we're going to talk about your time at Warner Brothers. But I want to start with, you're a poor boy in Oklahoma.
Okay. I was born.
I don't know that you were actually poor, but yes. We all were at one point. Right?
Here's the line. This is the first line of my book, by the way, is I was born a dirt poor half-breed from a broken home, and I was successful anyway.
Wow. Where in Oklahoma?
It's a little oil town called Barnsdall. It's north of Tulsa, middle of nowhere, 1,200 people. And, you know, in the 60s and 70s was a wonderful place to grow up. It was
really
just a little Oklahoma town, and I loved it. When I was a kid, I couldn't imagine not living in Oklahoma for the rest of my life.
Oh, wow.
Now I can't imagine living in Oklahoma again. But
I feel that way about Louisiana.
Yeah.
I'm so happy I came from a small town. I wasn't from New Orleans or Baton Rouge. I was from New Iberia, which was a small city or a really big town. And I loved growing up there. I don't think I could go back and live there, because I've become too accustomed to Nashville and everything that comes with it.
Yeah. But I couldn't make a living. It'd be my
exactly.
Problem,
it'd be really difficult for me to go back and make a living doing this in New Iberia, Louisiana. But God, it was a great place to grow up.
Yeah.
It really was. A joke that most people, when they grow up comfortably poor, or, you know, able to at least eat most of the time, they don't, when you're a kid, you don't realize, you know, I hear that all the time. Well, we were poor, but when I was a kid, I didn't realize we were poor. I asked my dad once if he knew they were poor growing up, and he goes, oh, we were the kind of poor where we knew it. I'm like, okay, that's a different level.
Yeah, I was too stupid to know I was poor. I'm probably too stupid not to know I'm poor now.
Well, when you're in a town of 1,200 people, you just, you know.
Yeah. My best friend growing up, no one was rich where I grew up.
Yeah.
But my best friend my whole life, his father owned the bank in town. So he was wealthy, you know, but we were best friends, and no one thought, oh, that's weird that kid and that kid are friends. You just, you know, 1,200 people, you don't have that many choices. So it's
how do you get into this? What happens? I know you started in radio, but how do you even get a job in radio in, what was it, Barnsdale?
Barnsdall.
Barnsdall.
Yes, it is. Can I tell you a quick story of why it's Barnsdall, Oklahoma?
Of course.
Because this is a glimpse into where I'm
from. We have no time limits except when you have to leave.
Okay. So, and when we run out of whiskey.
That's not going to happen. I got another bottle in the next room, just in case.
Where I'm from was originally called Big Heart, Oklahoma, because Chief Big Heart was an Osage chief, obviously a very Native American heavy area. Chief Big Heart was an Osage chief, and the community was named after Chief Big Heart.
Mm-hmm.
In the early 1900s, the streets were made with brick or dirt. There was no pavement. It was brick streets, so they were uneven and and grass growing through them and, you know, that kind of thing. So this guy named T.O. Barnsdall that had the Barnsdall Oil Company came to the city fathers and said, if you will change the name of your town from Big Heart to Barnsdall, I will pave your streets for you.
Sounds like a pretty good deal.
Yes. I mean, so, and we sold our souls for pavement.
For pavement. Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty classy, don't you think?
That's very classy.
Hey, sure, if you'll we'll come to my driveway, you can have my house. You can live in the basement.
I'll name my kid after you.
Yeah.
You know, which so, I mean, what's a kid's name? Yeah. You know, I mean, for free driveway.
Exactly.
Is that not to be? I mean, we make a lot of jokes with each other. Me being Cajun and fat white guy, and Gator being a Native American when we're all playing poker. But is that the tribe that you're?
No, the tribe is actually Potawatomi.
Potawatomi.
Yes, which no one's heard of unless you watch the Brewers play baseball, and behind home plate, the Potawatomi Casino has an advertisement.
So your tribe has its own casino.
Not that one, but yes.
But yes,
one in Kansas. Didn't when I was growing up, but it is. The Osages were rich. The Osage Reservation is one of the most oil-dense areas in the world. And the way the reservation works is you can own land there no matter who you are, but you only own like the first 14 inches. Everything below that belongs to the tribe, and that's where all the oil is. So they don't need a casino because they have oil. We needed a casino because we had a pasture in Kansas. but Potawatomi is the tribe. My tribe has about 4,000 total members, and people are always disappointed when they ask me what tribe I am, and I say Potawatomi because they want me to be something sexy like Cherokee or Apache. And
it's funny how when people who look white as the driven snow say that they're part Native American, they always manage to be a tribe you've heard of.
Yeah, it's almost always Cherokee.
It's almost always Cherokee.
Almost always.
Oh, well, I'm part Cherokee.
If you say you're Cherokee to a Native American, they're rolling their eyes whether you can see it or not.
They don't believe you.
And here's my Potawatomi story for you. Okay. This will tie it all back in to big and rich. So when you're a smart-ass kid from a small town and people roll their eyes, or you just see the disappointment when they say, what tribe? And you say Potawatomi, and they're like crestfallen. So I'm a smart-ass, so people went, Potawatomi? And so the story became, well, you know, we're not a very big tribe. The only thing we're really famous for is we're the tribe that introduced marijuana to the white man. And then they go, oh, whatever. And I'm like, no, why do you think they call it pot? And Big Kenny still believes that's a true story to this day. Until right now. If you're listening, Kenny, I'm really sorry, brother.
I always hope people are listening, but I actually hope he's not listening because I don't want him to find out. So that's not true, in case you're wondering. Although if I were Potawatomi, I would tell people that story too. Yeah, that's pretty great. Did you come up with that, or did someone pass that down?
No, that is a Gainer original because
that's why they
I used
call
to work
it
in
pot.
Radio, and you know,
come to think of it, I don't know why they call it pot. So yeah,
just
as
good
go
a reason
that.
As
that's
any.
That's a good
right?
a reason as any.
I'm going to start making shirts with the O being the leaf, and
why not?
Yeah,
go with it. So how do you get from Barnsdall, Oklahoma, to take us from there to Florida?
Well, I went to the University of Oklahoma.
Okay.
Nuclear engineering major. Not making that up.
that's a far cry from where you ended up, nuclear engineering.
Knowing me a little bit, you can imagine that, no offense to engineers, just not my personality, not what I want to do, was forced on me a little bit because I was good at math.
Side note real quick, my father is a master's civil engineer.
Yeah.
Top of his class in his master's program, and always thought I should follow in his foot. But again, once again, the personality does not go with engineering.
Yeah, you
all.
Also couldn't figure out how to turn the microphone
on.
It was
the microphone I had. I couldn't figure out how to make the theme song play. You know what? It's not my board. I'm not a very good producer anymore, so whatever.
So anyway, engineering made me lose my mind. I had to get out of that. I grew up listening as most people have, listening to the radio. I grew up in the 60s, 70s, a classic rock. What's classic rock now? It was just rock at the time, kid. But in college, discovered a guy named George Strait. Can tell you where I was the first time I heard Unwound on KVOO in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yeah.
And I love music. And it never occurred to me that people made a living on the business side of music. So I have no talent. Never occurred to me to move to Nashville and get into the music business because I don't have any talent.
Mm-hmm.
But radio seemed like, hey, that's a way that I can touch the music without actually needing to be musical. Went to the Connecticut School of Broadcasting.
Wow.
Got a gig doing 6 to midnight on an AM station in Fort Pierce, Florida.
Wait, the Connecticut School of Broadcasting, I don't sound like an idiot. Is that in Connecticut?
It actually was in North Palm Beach, Florida, okay. Where I went. I think there was one in Connecticut.
So, it's one of these things like the University of Phoenix, where there's satellite campuses or whatever.
Yeah, it's been a long time, but as I recall, the logo was a kind of a ripoff of CBS, too, and, you know.
Which so, you could get away with before the internet.
Yeah, yes, exactly. And but they taught me how to turn the microphone on the board and how to get the theme music to play and stuff like that. And so then I got a job at an AM station, a country station, which was what you do, you know. And from there, the good news about that is the guy that hired me about 6 months later, went to work for his old boss, and they put a new country station on the air in Fort Myers, Florida. And he was the promotions director and was helping hire the air staff and said, hey, there's this kid that I hired over there that would be great doing overnights. And they called, and that's when I became Gator Michaels for real. And I've been that for almost 30 years now, and no one knows my real name. It's a mystery.
I totally know your real name, by the way. But so, I won't tell.
Yeah, it is.
I've actually known you long enough that I know your
real name. That you know my real name. I will tell you that there are some people in radio that when they find out that's not your real name, you can see that they really haven't ever processed.
Yeah, they just assumed.
Yeah, I just assumed.
Which in this business, I don't understand how we assume anyone's name is real. No one's name is real. No one in the building I work in uses their real name.
Right.
So.
I got into radio. And about 5 years into radio, I was a music director and have all these regional record people calling me and it suddenly dawns on me that I can do that.
Yeah, you can do what they do.
I can do what they do, and that's my way to be part of it. I'd gone to West Palm, working for another startup radio station in West Palm, doing well. 6 months into that, the consultant comes in one day and says, hey, I've got an idea. We're going to do Howard Stern in the morning, country music the rest of the day.
Oh, my God.
It didn't work that well.
No kidding.
Yeah.
That, by the way, if you're not laughing at that, you've never worked in radio. If anyone working in radio is shaking their head and laughing to themselves listening to that.
It was worse than you can imagine.
Oh, I bet.
The very first day Howard was on the station, he spent an hour talking about Leanne Rimes' breast, and she was 13 at the time.
Oh, good job.
And our phones didn't stop ringing for the next 6 months. During the day, I had clients call and yell at me for something Howard said. And while I was on the air, you literally couldn't answer the phone. Every line in the studio would be lit up. And if you clicked the button and said hello, they just started yelling at you.
Yeah.
And you couldn't have a conversation. So the lines in the studio just always flashed. 6 months into that, I used to tell people, they'd call and ask you, how do I get to be a singer? You know, when you're in country radio, how do I get a record deal? And my advice was move to Nashville.
That's the first thing I say.
Yeah.
Step one, move to Nashville.
Show you're committed. There's so much talent in the city. They don't need to go outside the city limits to find an act. So
sometimes if you're scared of that, just on a side note, the other piece of good advice might be become the best singer, musician, artist in whatever town you're in. But even then, even when you're the king of, you know, Tulsa, Oklahoma, The next step is still move to Nashville.
They have to find you. And also, this is pre-internet, and they can't just Google you right. or get on YouTube and see that you have 107,000 followers. They have to search you out in that time. So my ex-wife said to me at the time, you know, it occurs to me that you know you want to be in the record business, and you tell singers that if they want to get a deal, they need to move to Nashville. Why does that not apply to you? I went in the next day, quit. Flew to Nashville, stayed with a friend, got a job at WSM, just doing whatever they needed me to do, on-air, production, remotes, whatever they needed me to do, I did it. Moved to Nashville 2 weeks later. First time my ex had ever seen the city. We were pulling the U-Haul in.
Wow.
And got a job doing independent promotion for $200 a week, working at SM, making $6 an hour, and here I am.
You did mornings in Fort Myers, right?
No, I did 7 to midnight.
7 to midnight.
Yeah. We were a personality radio station, and it was back in
now,
the day.
What's that like? Because that doesn't exist anymore.
It was 7 to midnight, and I did a request line show at a time when I was using one reel-to-reel machine.
Oh, my gosh.
We did have CD players, but one reel-to-reel machine, and I was taking phone calls in the room in the building by myself, 7 to midnight every night. No one else there. So I was answering the phone. I was playing the music. I was running commercials. I was taping the calls, and I was using a razor blade and splicing tape to get the phone calls from 3 minutes to 20 seconds.
I did that for about a year and a half when I was in high school. We used a reel-to-reel machine, and we actually had to edit it. But as soon as I got I moved to Baton Rouge when I was 18 to go to college at LSU, and I got a job there. And they had computers, and I was fascinated. I was like, wow, why haven't we been using computers? It's because I was working at a little radio station in New Iberia, Louisiana. They didn't have any.
When I got to WSM, they had a digital recorder, and it's like, I could have been the best jock on the planet.
Exactly. If I had had that, I could have done, imagine the things we could have done.
It was personality radio. We played a lot of music, but
it was about the personality.
It was
about the people.
We won because we had human beings that people like.
I think we all miss that. There's like this big hole where that doesn't exist anymore, you know?
Any time after 10 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah, exactly. Full disclosure, because not everybody knows this, but the company I work for has Big D and Bubba Show on in the mornings, and then we have Carson on in the middle of the day. If you're hearing this going, really? Not all of our affiliate stations carry Carson's show, but the difference with her is she's live, and she's here, and she's taking calls. So we found that a lot of places that don't do that.
No, and she's good.
And she's good. And if you have live jocks in your local city, that's fantastic, but so many people don't have that. So we try to make sure. We may not be there, but we are trying to bring personality to the radio one way or another.
And full disclosure, I'm not poking at you guys because I think what you guys do is great.
Because we're awesome. So why would
it's just, you know, you have an ACM award.
Yeah.
I don't have
CMA.
One of those.
You don't have a CMA?
I don't have either. Like me personally, you know, they don't give them to record guys. Aww. They give them to the artist, and they say thank you to the record guys, you know, off television, like with a note with, you know, hey, thanks for the.
So Gator and I play in this little poker league that it's all people who work in the music industry. So mostly what we do is drink beer and whiskey, and we eat cheap pizza, and we make fun of each other.
Yes.
So the first game we played, there were 7 people in that room, and in that room there were 9 CMA awards. And I love to say there were 9 CMA awards in that room.
Yeah.
Well, between me and Lon Helton, there are 9 CMA awards. It was really just the two of us. And really, I only have 1, and Lon has 8.
Yes.
And so last month after he came back, and after the most recent CMAs where he won again, I said, now we have 10 CMA awards in the room.
It's impressive.
Lon has 9.
It is... you know, part of why I got into radio is Bob Kingsley, speaking of CMA awards, and no disrespect to Lon, but in Tulsa, Oklahoma, I grew up, the station carried the Kingsley Countdown, And that voice was, you know, it's Bob Kingsley. I mean, right. You just, he walks in the room, you don't have to see him. He says hello and you know it's Bob Kingsley. And probably, it's certainly one of the top five proudest moments of my life was the day I realized not only did Bob Kingsley know who I was, but he considered me to be his friend. And it's that's cool for a little kid, you know?
I feel that way, and no disrespect to Bob, but the radio station I grew up listening to carried Lon Helton. So for me, it was the same thing. Yeah. It was like when we met Lon Helton, it was like, oh, cool, that's Lon Helton. He does the countdown.
Yeah.
And then when you get to kind of run into him, because he also runs a magazine here in town, and you'd see him at events and he would know who you were. And it was like, oh, wow, cool, Lon Helton. Yeah. Now we play poker together and I consider Lon a friend.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, my gosh, that's crazy. You know, I have a 45 record of Tracy Lawrence Sticks and Stones that I bought when I was 14 years old. Okay. It is a 45. They weren't even really making records anymore. For some reason, I had not switched to CDs, I guess. I don't know. But I still have that on 45. And like sometimes I think about the fact that every week I am in a studio basically co-hosting and producing a show with Tracy Lawrence on the radio every week.
Yeah.
That's crazy. I went to his, Halloween party. I'm sure he doesn't know yet, but he's going to get a wedding invitation. He's like one of those type of friends.
Yeah.
And I go, to a little kid growing up in Louisiana, it's like you with John Anderson. Yeah. It's a similar thing, you know? It's like to think, I can't believe I'm here doing this.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a really crazy business.
When I decided not to be an engineer, actually I was going to be the president, but lawyer and then an engineer before that is what they made me do. But my mother and my grandmother were devastated that I was getting into the entertainment business. I joke about it a lot. I don't think I was a very good jock, but I worked for a good radio station and we had great numbers. And I was successful at radio. I moved to Nashville and I worked for an independent record company and we did very well and we were very successful for a couple of years. And my mother and my grandmother didn't act like they weren't proud, but, you know, I was the disappointment.
Yeah. I was the disappointment until my mom got to, you know, meet Blake Shelton or something. Yeah. And it was like,
well, I went to work for Kenny Rogers.
Oh.
The day I went to work for Kenny Rogers, they told everybody
what
I did.
They started telling people what you did.
It's like, what's he doing for a living? Oh, he works for And then it was, he works for Kenny Rogers.
Yeah.
and it was, it just changed everything. And in lots of ways, honestly. Professionally, but it also being small town, people that you grow up with have no concept of your life.
None.
Zero. I had my best friend, she was born less than a month before me. We've known each other literally our whole lives, went to church together as children, probably the first human being my age outside of my family I ever met. And when I was working with Kenny, she was trying to get me to get involved in, you know, some kind of project with her. And I just said, look, honestly, I travel so much. I just couldn't really do anything for you because I'm just never home like that. And she said, okay, well, I guess I understand that. She said, hey, can I just ask you a question? So have you actually met Kenny Rogers?
No, I haven't. Yeah. but it doesn't come around.
It's just so surreal to the people in where I grew up.
Right.
They don't know, and they don't. It's weird because they do. When you go home, and the people you went to high school with and stuff, do they like not know how to talk to you anymore?
The people that I'm still friends with, half of them don't know anything about country music and couldn't and see what I do as some sort of weird thing.
Yeah.
That like I'm told that that Patrick is famous, but I've never heard of him. So there's those people, and then there's the friends who listen every day, and who are really into country music and and know all about everything that I've done, I'm doing, and everything. And even those guys, they don't treat me any differently, but they clearly don't have a concept of what it means to do this, you know, and to just to be, I mean, just to live in Nashville, just to live in Nashville is a whole different experience. When I can be driving down Music Row and pass, like we talked about earlier, John Rich in a Cadillac with the big horns on it. I mean, I had that experience more than once when you guys were all at Warner, where he would just be driving down 16th in that Cadillac and you'd see it and go, well, that's something that doesn't happen in Tulsa, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I was at an event recently and walking by a group of people, and they're like, ah, Gator, you'll be good at this. I'm like, what? We're playing Most Famous Person in Your Phone.
And did you have Kenny Rogers? Because I think you win if you have Kenny Rogers in your phone.
Well, this is some industry people. There were some real things in there.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, I have some people in my phone.
Yeah.
The problem is...
You have me in your phone.
I do. Even more than that, I have Big D in my phone.
Oh, wow. Super famous.
Yes. So, but it's that thing. And in my phone, because I worked at Warner, we had people in our phones at the time because you had like a global company directory kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So... You know, I had Madonna's phone number.
Oh, my God. yeah, I think you win. You win.
But an A&R guy, this is a true story, an A&R guy at Warner lost his phone, and somebody found it, and he didn't have a lock on it, and they were calling Madonna because he actually had Madonna. It's like you open his phone, and it said Madonna. If you go through my phone for the famous people, there's like a really loose code, but it doesn't say Kenny Rogers in my phone.
Okay. Does it say the gambler? What is the code? What's the code?
It is. It just says there. Sir.
It says big white beard.
Yes.
Really tight face.
It's man that looks like Kenny Rogers.
Yeah, man that looks like Kenny Rogers.
He is.
Okay, who won the game of most famous person in your phone?
I won.
Yeah, you won.
I won the game.
You did.
Yeah.
Was it Kenny Rogers that won?
No, I think actually it was Faith.
Oh yeah, that's pretty bad. I mean,
Kenny Rogers, a generation ago, you know, Faith. I have some current people, you know, Blake's. You know, quite frankly, it's probably Blake.
Yeah, Blake's easily the most famous person in Nashville or in country music.
Yeah, and again, you get outside of Nashville, Blake is, you know, it's Blake and Taylor. Even more than anybody else, because if you're on television, Keith now, you know?
Yeah.
But it's really Blake.
Oh, it's, yeah. I think Blake Shelton might be more famous outside of country music than Garth Brooks. I mean, it's that level now.
Yeah, I mean...
Especially to people who Garth disappeared. So there's younger people who don't listen to country music who have no idea who he is.
You know, Blake is, is the biggest star on NBC. Not my opinion. Like, NBC's opinion. And
I can't disagree with that at all. Like, I can't think of anyone who's bigger.
You know, they do studies and the Q scores and all that. And Blake's the guy. And he is, I know Blake. I worked with Blake. I love Blake Shelton. I think he's a fantastic human. And I'm really proud of him. But he is like TV star.
Yeah.
In addition to country music star, he's like Matthew Perry or Courtney Cox or one of those Big Bang kind of people. You're on TV every week and people see you week in and several times a week and you're a massive star. People recognize you on the street. You know, with internet, it's more common with artists, but, you know, they don't get to see us right now.
No.
They're not watching us on the radio. So Q scores for singers, it used to be really low, and it's still not giant. I mean, Ed Sheeran's one of the biggest stars on the planet.
There are people who know him and could pick him out of a lineup.
Ed can walk down the street. It's not a problem. You get a minor TV star, and they get mobbed everywhere they go.
Right.
So Blake Shelton, biggest name in my phone.
By far.
Yeah. Well, I mean, other than you.
Other than me. Thank you. I want to, I knew I was going to bring this up, and it's not going to be easy for me, and it'll be harder for you, I'm sure. But it would be silly if we sit here and talk about you and me and our friendship and your career and all those things without bringing up David. And mm-hmm. when you and I met, it was through David Haley. Mm-hmm. So before I moved to Nashville, Big D and Bubba was a radio show. We were in Baton Rouge. We were syndicated on, I think, 14 stations, which at the time made us the biggest syndicated morning show in American country music. Yeah. Country music radio didn't do that. So it got the attention of a couple of people in Nashville in the record industry that went, we should be talking directly to this show as opposed to just the stations that they're mm-hmm. on.
Right.
And I got a call from a guy named Shane Allen who told me that his boss, David Haley, which was at MCA, I mm-hmm. believe, had told him that he should reach out to certain morning shows, and we were one of them. So I got to build a relationship with – that was my first record rep. Before that, I was just the morning show producer.
Yeah.
Nobody from the record companies called me. They called the program director. Then I started basically getting connections with all of the record companies myself. And it all started because of something David Haley decided was a good idea. Yep. So when I moved to Nashville, one of the handful of people I knew was David Haley. Mm-hmm. So the first time I went to meet with him, I met you. And that's how you and I met, almost certain. I'm not 100% sure because there's probably whiskey involved. If not at that time, since then, so that I've forgotten things. But I think that's how we met. So how did you meet David? How did you end up working for him at Warner Brothers?
David, I met in a similar fashion. I was a music director in Fort Myers, and David was the head of promotion, the VP of promotion at MCA. They were the label of the decade. David, an incredible human being, but an incredible record guy. He mm-hmm. was intricately involved in the careers of George Strait and Reba McEntire, Vince Gill, Trisha Yearwood, Marty Stewart, the Mavericks, and I'm forgetting dozens and dozens and dozens.
Honestly, you could have stopped at George Strait and Reba and Vince Gill, and we'd have been like, oh, I got you, big guy.
He was pretty cool, but also the sweetest and maybe funniest human being that I personally knew. But David was very business savvy, and he was always doing things like, he preached things like, you treat everyone well because, A, I'm from Jackson, Mississippi, and I was raised to treat people well, and B, you never know who someone's going to become.
Exactly.
And why not? It's not hard. And Shane Allen is the perfect example of that, because Shane started answering David's phones because David thought he was a good kid, and now he's a hotshot VP at Sony.
At Sony, yeah.
And a brilliant kid. He's not a kid. You're not a kid either, but you were when I met you, and that's what I think of you guys, or how I think of you guys still.
David Haley used to treat me, when I first moved to Nashville, like I was the president of Clear Channel. I've said that. I said that when he passed. By the way, if you haven't caught on yet, we're talking about a friend of ours who's no longer with us. But I said that in my little, mini obituary that I wrote, that I said, he treated me like I was the head of Clear Channel, and I was the producer of one radio show.
Yeah.
With, at the time, no real power to create change in the way the records were being presented. I had some control over which artists we featured. And that was it. I had no value to him in his position at that moment. And it didn't matter because, one, he was a nice guy. And two, like you said, you never know who somebody is going to become.
Yes.
I didn't become anyone, but that's not the point. All joking aside, I went from that, in 2003, 15 years later, the president of a syndication company that, we have shows on over 175 radio stations every week.
Yeah.
And, I'm still not really anybody that can create change the way he thought of it, but it's not nothing.
Anybody creates change that's willing to. Mm-hmm. It takes a point, but I'm about to get on a soapbox and I'm not going to do it. I'm going to tell you about David.
Please.
For those of you who don't know David, He was a character. He was 100% Irish from Jackson, Mississippi. And he called everyone daddy. Hey, daddy.
Hey, daddy.
Hey, daddy. And David was impeccably dressed always.
Yeah.
He was.
You used to dress better when you worked for him. Just well, for the record, I probably rubbed off.
I dressed better after I worked for him at Warner, too. But I will tell you that, well, this is psychobabble, but the suits and Warner are too closely connected for my comfort level anymore.
Oh, okay.
So there comes a time when you get out of the radio promotion and I'm more involved in the creative side and artist and interact with the artist more directly in what we call A&R. So artists got freaked out by the suit.
Yeah.
So now that I need artists to relate with me differently, truly is why I'm not don't wear suits anymore. But David was the guy that always had an extra shirt and tie behind his door.
Yeah.
In the office. Do you know why he called everybody daddy?
No.
Because David has passed. I am not divulging his secret anymore,
mm-hmm.
but David called everybody daddy because his memory was horrible. And his father was the same thing. And his father owned a convenience store in Jackson. And when you call everybody daddy, you don't have to remember their names. And you have to be consistent with it, though. You can't just call the people you don't know daddy. He called everybody. He called me daddy.
Yeah.
Every day he called me daddy. But it wasn't entirely because he couldn't remember people's names and he never wanted to offend somebody by not because again, when you're in our positions, you meet a lot of people.
Yeah.
And when you meet David Haley, it may be the biggest thing that happens to you that week. So for him, it's just one of the people he met that week.
Yeah.
And so he hated to offend people. So he developed this habit of calling everybody daddy. It was kind of his catchphrase. And everybody, if you said daddy, people would go, David Haley.
Right. And he
truly is a legend in this business. He's why I am where I am. I worked with Kenny Rogers, but in a small independent record company, and David worked for MCA. And when he went to work at Warner Brothers, he brought me in to work with him. And that's kind of the point that my career exploded. Not that I didn't earn my way to that point, but David still had to be the guy that said, I believe in this guy, mm-hmm. and I'm going to give him the opportunity to prove that he belongs here. And I owe everything to David Haley, everything.
I remember the strangest things. I remember the suit he wore to the CMA Awards in 2003 because he invited me to the awards, and then I didn't even live here. Mm-hmm. We had just announced we were moving here, and I made a deal with my mom. My dad's an engineer. I said, if you can convince Dad to come up for a week, because I'm only going to be in Nashville for a week at a time, to come up to that and help me look at houses because he will see things I don't see.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, rather than just by myself going, I need a second set of eyes. So you convince him to take a week off work and come up and help me look at houses. And then I will take you to the CMA Awards because they're that week. And then she convinced him to do that. So I have to take her to the CMA Awards. So I called David and he got me a pair of tickets, which at the time was even harder than it is now because it was in the Opry House.
Yeah, it's a couple thousand people, yeah, all industry.
All industry. So we go to the Warner Brothers after party, and he was wearing, I recall, it was a silver suit.
Mm-hmm.
It was like silver thread, shiny, like when he walked in, light reflected off of him.
And probably an apricot shirt and a purple tie.
A purple tie, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It was outrageous, but it was also just, it was perfect.
Mm-hmm.
It was exactly who I wanted him to be.
Uh-huh.
At that point, I'd only really talked to him on the phone and met him once. My last episode, in case anyone's actually listened to both of these, featured my friend Damian Boggs, who's a singer-songwriter and an independent artist. And he and I, the only gig I ever played in Nashville, we mentioned that. I played one gig in Nashville. We used to play three times a week in Baton Rouge.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I did a double bill at Wolfie's on Broadway. And David Haley and Gator Michaels showed up to watch our set. Like, I still can't believe you came to that. You, first of all, David probably dragged you. There's no way you thought that was a good idea.
No, I mean, you make it sound like David was the nice one. I'm not saying you're not nice.
I'm saying that you might have been like, what the hell are we doing?
Yeah, no, it was, honestly, and people still think that they tell me I shouldn't do the things I do still to this day. Why are you meeting with that person?
Why are you here doing this podcast?
Because you asked me to.
Because I asked you to, and that's, you're way too nice.
You know, but I meet with people all the time, and no one understands, but I will tell you, and it's even beyond David. This town is a town of paying it forward.
Yep.
There were people that helped David when he moved to town for apparently no reason at all. When I moved to town, there were people that helped me for apparently no reason at all, just because that's what you do. Hey, there's this kid. He's a good kid. I'm going to help him. I'm going to get him CMA tickets. I'm going to help him get a job. I'm going to help him with a place to live. It happens in this town all the time.
Right.
And I tell everybody that works with me when they first start, this is the way it works. I believe in you. I've hired a lot of people right out of college or right as they move to town that have no experience. And I think you're smart. I think you're bright. I like you. We're going to see if we can figure this out. But here's the deal. Someday when you're making decisions, you have to remember that. And you have to help a kid
right. That
you have no reason helping. You have to help them because that's the way we do it. And David was kind of the personification of that. And you know, I also went to see you do stand-up.
Well, that was worth it, though, because I was probably hilarious. I don't know that it was worth you coming to hear me sing when I was 24 years old. But it was definitely worth you coming to see me do stand-up.
You had better hair then.
I did, man. I had some good hair. This has now come up in both podcasts, both episodes so far of my former rock and roll hair, but it was so good.
It was good.
I'm thinking about growing it back out, but it's gray now, and that would be weird.
You wouldn't be the only one.
I wouldn't. There's a time in your life as a man, and some would say even as a woman, where you could put up with having long hair.
Yeah.
And then that time gets past you, and you go, I'm not doing that anymore.
Yeah.
That was ridiculous. I can't believe.
Yep.
I actually used to, I mean, just to wash 3 feet of hair and then wait for it to dry was a thing, you know?
Yeah.
I don't want to do that anymore.
No.
I don't, that's, you know, I'm going to grow the beard out and see if anyone notices. I don't know. I will say when David passed, that was the thing everybody remembered about him. They remembered that he was hilarious,
mm-hmm.
which I hope people remember that about me. And they remembered that he was kind.
Mm-hmm.
That he was over the top kind.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, like I said, I remember that he treated me at 24 years old like I was somebody that he was supposed to be treating with that kind of respect. I feel like when you're gone, that's what we're going to say about you. And I hope it's the same thing with me. We can only hope that because that's what's going to matter.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I look at the times in my life where I help someone who, for no reason at all, and he's one of the people that I learned that from.
Yeah.
You know, and you're right there with him, buddy.
You just do it. I think about him every day, and I will drink to him.
Absolutely.
A man that didn't drink.
A man that did not drink. Came with us to an LSU football game one time and just laughed at us for drinking, for doing shots.
Yes.
It's like, the game's more fun if you're sober. I don't think that's true. We're playing Vanderbilt. I think it's more fun if you drink. I'm just saying. Okay.
Wow, you said that in Nashville.
I said that, well, yeah.
But, both Vandy fans are going
to
be
both Vandy fans. Dude, I have been to LSU away games at Ole Miss, Tennessee, Arkansas, Mississippi State, Alabama, and I haven't done Alabama yet, and several others, but also here in Vanderbilt. And Vandy's the only place where you're not outnumbered.
Yeah.
Because when I went in 05 and 10, there were more LSU fans in that stadium than Vanderbilt fans.
Yes. Well, David, speaking of David was an Ole Miss fan.
Oh, yeah.
And he had Vandy season tickets because they were so inexpensive that he would buy 2 years of season tickets for the one game every year that Ole Miss came here to play.
They were like $12 a piece back in the day.
Yeah, so he'd just buy season tickets. He had like 50-yard line seats at Vandy games, and he went one time every other year.
Yep. Ole Miss Vandy, that used to be the one game they played each other every year from each division. Before we're done, we have to talk about, okay, so what are you doing, Gator? What do you do now?
I run a little record company called Reviver, an entertainment group, technically. We have a record company, and we have a publishing company, and we have a film division and a legacy division. You know, I worked with Locash, and we work with David Lee Murphy. And, you know, to add David Lee Murphy and Kenny Chesney to my list of people I've had number ones with, pretty cool. At two for the price of one, and David Lee is the coolest man alive currently. So, you know, and one of the sweetest. And we have several young artists, Michael Tyler, Tennille Arts, Haley Michaels, Josh Grayson, Aaron Goodwin that we're working with, and brilliant young songwriters. And one of the truly special things we're doing right now, I don't even know if you know this, we have a legacy division that started with Arlene Mandrell, which is the youngest Mandrell sister.
Mm-hmm.
But we have...
Her daughter does a podcast for this company.
Oh, does she really?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there you go.
It's a small world.
It is a small world. It's a small town.
Yeah, that's what it is.
So from that, we have a trilogy of records, one that's out, one that's coming soon, that's finished, and a third one in the process. But John Carter Cash, who is Johnny and June's son, has had a solo record we put out last year that he did, that's really cool and kind of a alt Americana, you know, one of those things of no one really knows what it is. It's just cool. But we have this project that John Carter produced for us, co-produced for us, but it's a Carter family album. And it has never before heard recordings of the Carter sisters being Helen, Anita, and June, Carter Cash.
Mm-hmm.
And then John Carter took it, and there are now six generations of the Carter family, including Maybelle, Mother Maybelle Carter, and Sarah Carter on this project. Grandchildren, Carlene Carter is on it, and Danny, and I mean, it's this beautiful record that has been modernized. It was recorded in the early 80s and sat
right
in a vault.
Just, it's amazing to think all of the things in this town that have never been released.
Yeah, so we have that coming probably first quarter of 2020, maybe as early as the end of this year. But it is again, when you say, I got to work with Kenny Rogers, I got to work with John Anderson, that's iconic. And to say you got to work a Carter family project and I get to do something that Maybelle Carter's playing on and Sarah Carter singing on is just mind-boggling to me. And then the third piece of that is a project that I can't really talk about yet, but it'll be brand new music from someone who is very close to the Carter family. So
okay, we'll just leave that there.
Yeah. So that's going to be really cool, and that will probably come out early next year as well. So
obviously the whole business has changed since you moved here, but is there something that you see in the future with streaming that will possibly completely turn this thing upside down? Is there a second wave of people buying records, or is that completely gone and we have to change the whole thought process?
The old ways are gone. The only thing that on physical product is vinyl. There is an audiophile niche that is always going to keep vinyl. Vinyl is actually the only form of music consumption, physical music consumption, that grows. As CD sales and even digital downloads are plummeting,
just going away,
vinyl sales are growing year over year. But that's an audiophile thing, and that's got a cap on it.
I will tell you this. I think the audiophiles are about 20 to 30% of the people who buy vinyl. I think vinyl is more of a collectability thing.
It's way cooler
Cool. I love to collect records, but I don't even really listen to them. We listen to them here at the office. It's not like I listen to them at home.
And most of the people on the turntable own a turntable that has a USB out. And sorry, that's not
it. It doesn't work.
You've lost the audiophile component.
It's not it. But there's something about owning it.
Yes.
That's cool.
There's
a small niche of people who still understand that. But that's the part I think that might bring it back. It's the same thing with books. It's used to own books and keep a big collection to show these are all the books I have. And there was some pride in that. And now it's like, well, I read it on my Kindle or my iPad and then I don't have it. But what happens when, you know, I don't know, you can't pass that down. You can't pass down digital files to your kids. You know, I think people are going to.
But here's the other thing. You can sit with your kids now and still play them the music.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, and this is just for me personally, at the end of the day, it's the song and it's where that song takes you in your mind that is the most important part of a music collection.
Mm-hmm.
I remember where I was the first time for me in country music, and just the truth, I know exactly where I was when I heard George Strait Unwound. I know exactly where I was when I heard the Judds do Mama, He's Crazy. And I know exactly where I was when I heard Diamond Rio Meet in the Middle for the very first time. And I heard them all on the radio. And those are three songs from my younger days that shaped who I am now. And again, crazy parts of our lives. I have met George Strait. I met Wynonna and Naomi, and I'm friends with Diamond Rio. So how cool is that?
It's extremely cool.
Yeah.
I remember hearing songs on the radio for the first time. For me, the one that sticks out more than country music even was the first time I heard Disarmed by the Smashing Pumpkins. I remember exactly where I was. I was sick at school. I was in the ninth grade. My dad had come pick me up from school, which was unusual because I don't know about you, but growing up, it was always mom you called when you're sick. But my dad was working 30 and 30s.
Yeah.
So he had 30 days where he wasn't, where he was at home, just like working on the yard or whatever. Yeah. And so he was the one who had to come in. I remember that's the last time I ever called in sick, knowing that my dad was going to be the one who picked me up. But he turned the rock radio station on, and I heard that song, and I had to go buy that CD. It was just something that, but my bigger memories, and I see this with my daughter, it's not the same. My bigger memories were my dad taking these records out and saying, I'm going to play you this song. He had to pull the record out, and he'd hand you the sleeve while he got the record and put it on and queued it up and got to that song. And I remember him playing A Stairway to Heaven and the build up to it.
Yeah.
You know, at 6, 7 years old, explaining how cool this record was and why it was so important and all that. And I pulled it up on Spotify for my daughter, and she was like, okay, this is no different than every other song that we pull up. But at the same time, on the converse of that, I have the entirety of music history almost at my fingertips in my hand.
The salvation of commercial music is these little telephones. And streaming services, it just is.
There are a lot of people who don't feel that way. A lot of people think it's the ruination of it, but you think it's the salvation?
Absolutely. And here's why. You told me you have a 45 of Sticks and Stones
because
you could afford it. You don't have the Tracy Lawrence album because as a kid, you couldn't afford to go spend, at that time, probably $12.
Whatever.
But you could buy a single. CDs killed singles. They weren't practical. Commercially, they cost as much to make as a whole album, and they took as much space in the stores as a whole album, and record stores were going away. So there were no CD singles.
There were, but it was
not very long.
Not very many, yeah.
And you didn't sell any of them. And so kids became – there's a generation of kids that became song fans, not artist fans. You didn't become a Tracy Lawrence fan because of that one single. You could discover more and more. There was a B-side. There was an investment in an artist, and you could discover who an artist was beyond just what you heard on the radio. The digital world has made it so kids can afford to discover an artist and invest in artists. And they don't even have to be on record labels anymore. I mean, Kane Brown had an enormous fan base before he had a record deal. The record deal's blown him up beyond imagination, but people
huge fan base just from
in
Facebook.
That artist, and then that artist can make a living because that artist can go on the road and tour and sell tickets and make money, and they can survive and they can flourish, and it's more than just a one-hit wonder, flash in the pan kind of thing. And I mean, I grew up a kid with vinyl music and CDs or 45s and singles, and you'd buy a single, you'd hear it on the radio, and if you liked it enough on the radio, you'd go and buy it at a record store, and you'd buy the single, and you'd turn it over, and you'd listen to the B-side, and if you like that, then you'd save up your money, and you'd go buy the whole album,
yeah.
And that was an investment, emotional investment in music. Kids are getting emotionally invested in music again, and that's exciting to me.
I don't disagree with that, but there's the other side that says that people want to actually invest in it. And when things – because there have been study after study that have shown when you give stuff away for free, people don't place any value on it. Mm-hmm. People would rather pay something for it. And I wonder if people don't even – what you pay for Apple Music or Spotify or Amazon – becomes part of your regular, but you don't even see it as you're paying for it. You see it as free. I can go get this in anything I want. It's all on my streaming service. So there isn't any investment in it.
I will tell you the opposite for television is the exact opposite. It was always free.
That's true.
And when cable came in, I'm not paying for television. Television's free. And it may be true that people think it has a higher value if I had to save up and buy that. Mm-hmm. That's more precious to me. But
I literally had a conversation this morning about a live show that we're doing about giveaways. Like, I don't mind putting tickets aside for giveaways, but the problem is that's going to be people who don't show up. Because people who get free tickets are less likely to show up than people who pay for even $5 for a ticket will show up.
Yeah.
Well, to a show because they're invested in it.
If I win tickets from Big D and Bubba, I'm a Big D and Bubba fan.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean I care about whatever I won tickets to. Yeah, whatever the tickets are for, I got to talk to Big D, and that's the motivation for
winning. I got to talk to Big D yesterday. It's not that big a deal.
Well, you and I know that, but you know, there are some people that think he's cool.
There was somewhere else I was going to go with that, talking about the music, which was that, you know—
You asked me what the next big thing is.
Yeah, what is it?
The thing that absolutely kills all sales of recorded music is 5G. When 5G is prevalent, it is so good and so fast that...
I mean, is 4G not fast enough for music streaming?
It is.
Because...
It is.
It's pretty fast.
It is fast, but there still those lag times, and there's still those little circles that spin for a second every now and then. And 5G is. There's always lag time in anything, but it is so fast that the lag time is basically imperceptible, and it creates things like self-driving cars and the interaction, the computer, like humans probably can't tell the difference between 4G and 5G so much, but computers can. And so the interface between your car and the service are going to be seemingly instantaneous. So it's going to make all of those things, the bandwidth, everything just becomes so much better. The access to files, probably more video streaming than even music streaming, is going to become so good that it is going to change everything. So the way we consume music and videos will change again in the next couple of years as they're rolling out 5G this year on AT&T.
Well, you said this streaming allows people to get to know artists, and that allows artists to make a living. But that's the artist. What about the machinery? What about the industry that's built up around music?
It is all things change, and you have to adapt, and you have to, you know, it becomes my opinion. I used to work for a major record company. I work for a small record company now. But record companies are designed to be small businesses. That's how they work.
Boy, that's not what most of them are, even still.
It's not, but it's how they work. I mean, the overhead is absurd. Maybe I'm naive or idealistic, but a record company or a music company should be about music first, not about stock market, not about investors, not about year-over-year profit lines. It's about, if you make great music, I'll figure out how to get it to people, and people will consume it. That's what I believe. And that's...
Isn't that cute?
Yeah. but you can make money doing that. You can make a living doing that because there's demand for music. I've done this my entire adult life, and the record part of it for over 20 years, and I've never been more excited about the business of music.
Wow.
It's the Wild West as far as I'm concerned, and we're figuring it out. It changes constantly. We figure out how to monetize it. And some people are going to get left behind, and that's sad, but, you know, that is no different in any other industry in the world. You know, modernization changes things, and you either adapt to it or you don't.
We had Darius Rucker in on the show, not this show, the other show that I work for, and he said, you know, he started in the early 90s with Hootie, and that back then, the only reason anybody went on tour was to promote their record.
Right.
And now the only reason you make a record is so that you can do media and promote
your tour. Yeah, exactly.
Like, the business has completely flipped upside down, because the touring is the one thing that the technology can't replicate.
Right.
You want to go. You want to be in that room with other people and your favorite artist and stand and be a part of some live thing, you know. So if the technology can't replicate that, there must be some other part of this that, you know, there are people who say that none of us will have jobs because computers will do all of them. And I like to think that,
what computers can't do is the intangible of what you're going to like. They can't, you know, music is a very human business. It is, I talk about how you market music is so unique, because if you're marketing Coke and the Coca-Cola doesn't care what color the can is, it doesn't care if it's this color red, that color red, it doesn't matter what the font is, it doesn't matter if the font's green or purple or New York Times, or if it's in a bottle or a can or a plastic bottle or a glass bottle, it's Coke. Right? You know, it's just Coke. What I market are human beings. And they very much care how they're marketed, because they're humans and they're individuals.
Right.
A Coke is a Coke is a Coke. The Coke you get in San Diego tastes just like the Coke you get in Washington, D.C. David Lee Murphy is very different than Tennille Arts. So the way you market those things has to be just as different.
It has to fit who they are.
Yes. And that's why music... That's the live part of it. That's the part of music that I love, is it's real. It's individual. It is, and it's taste, and things that you love, I may not love, and things that I love, you may think are stupid. I work with Bob Reeves. Everything I love, he thinks is stupid. To me, it's exciting, because there are hundreds of millions of people that have access to my music now, and they get to decide if they like it or not. And that's all I do for a living. I put it out there, and then people get to decide if they like it.
I mean, look, this is very much what we're doing right now. This podcast is me doing something just because I want to.
Yeah.
Just because maybe there's an audience out there that'll listen to it and we'll get feedback on it. But there's no money being made doing this, at least not in the early stages of it, because quite frankly, no one's listening. I, you know. And by having guests as famous as Gator Michaels, no one's going to listen.
No, that's the thing. That's the reason I'm doing this podcast, because no one's going to hear it. There's no money at stake, so what do you care?
Yeah, I was going to say maybe Bob will listen, but even Bob won't listen to this. There's no chance.
Well, so. You know, there's at least, you know, 12 or 15 people will listen because they just suck up to me.
Yeah, to suck up to you because you told them to. Hey, listen, that'll be almost as many people as I got to listen last week. So I'm in, you know. Before we finish, I just want to say, is Bob Reeves, in fact, the crotchetiest person that you've ever met?
Because no one's listening?
No, I mean, people are listening. I'm saying that knowing even Bob might hear this.
Bob is the sweetest man on the planet.
He really is.
Yes.
But, man, he plays that character so well.
He does, and it's not – he is a conundrum because it's – That's also he's also the crotchetiest man on the planet, but he's also the sweetest man on the planet.
And I think you have to be that crotchety. I think deep down you have to be actually a nice guy underneath.
He is gruff to get away with and comes off like, ooh, I don't know. And then ask him about his cat. That's what I tell people all the time. Ask him about his cat.
No way.
Yeah.
This guy that we're talking about that none of you know, he reminds me of like a real life Lewis Black. Not that Lewis Black's not a real person, but like, you know, Bob's not a comedian. He's not at all putting on an act. This is just how he is. Mm-hmm. That's got to be fun to show up at the office every day, and see what that version of.
He doesn't like you at all, by the way.
So. Oh, I know. I won in the poker game last time we played, and so Bob is still mad at me.
I have a message for you, but I can't even say it on the internet. So.
That was a little bad. I won a little bit too much. You ever win so much in a poker game that you actually feel like, I call it reverse tilt, where you're actually starting to play more cautiously because you feel bad about how much you're winning.
Yeah.
That's how I felt.
Yeah, you suck. Which is actually why I'm here, because I am an indentured servant.
Yeah, so. you lost the bet in the poker game, which led to you having to come and do this podcast.
But I do have to depart.
No, I know. We're wrapping up. I want to say thank you to Gator Michaels for showing up and doing this. I really do appreciate it, especially since we've already established no one is listening.
Yes.
So this is really just you and I talking to each other. And we did drink Redneck Riviera whiskey today without an official sponsorship.
Thank you, John.
Which led for us to tell stories about John Rich. Yes. And I think we didn't even tell that many John Rich stories.
No. None
considering
of the good
how
ones.
Much, none of the good ones. You got a good short one you want to throw at us before you leave?
A good short John Rich story, not one that I can tell in public. Even if no one's listening, all my John Rich stories are not repeatable. And John will appreciate that.
And John will appreciate that we didn't tell that story. This podcast, Five Whiskey Patrick, is a service of Silverfish Media and Compass Media Networks. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next week.